Please abort and retry.
Just Reloaded.com.
All our music comes from the heart and soul. Start by listening. It is music that takes its roots from Africa.
Just Reloaded.
We embrace the rule, but we are
the collective set of building blocks from which human reality is made.
JazzReloaded.com. Jazz changes.
It's as if there is this great reservoir outside of time and space. Patterns, energy.
This is a very, very important message.
It is a system which has conscripted human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine.
JazzReloaded.com.
Mankind struggles to get a definition like this.
Combine diplomatic, intelligent, economic, scientific, and political.
Funny, because I don't know anything about music.
You don't have to know anything about music. Just listen to it, that's all.
First of all, you have to respect your whole culture.
Are you ready?
Music from some other land, made in England.
Well, what do you think?
You should do it.
Just open up the mind.
Just so, spoken word, from the roots to the fruits. This is Just Reloaded.
I will not make any deals with you. I resigned. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, deed, or number. My life is my own.
Just Reloaded.
Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, he who could address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before an assembly more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. A feeling has crept over me quite unfavorably to the exercise of my limited powers of speech. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. Your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and quality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bomb blast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages.
Had I interfered in the matter in which I admit has been fairly proved, had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, or in behalf of any of their friends, either father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or children, or any of that class, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right. And every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than punishment. This court acknowledges, I suppose, the validity of the law of God. I see a book kissed here, which I suppose it to be the Bible, or at least the New Testament. That teaches me that whatsoever I would that men should do unto me, I should do even so to them. It teaches me further to remember them that they are in bonds as bound with them. I endeavor to act up to that instruction. I say I am yet too young to understand that God is any respecter of persons. I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted that I have done, in behalf of his despised poor, was not wrong, but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children, and with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I submit, so let it be done.
Yes, this is TaylorMade Radio. I hope you enjoyed that tribute to our brothers and sisters beyond the Atlantic pond. 2011 is the UN declared International Year for People of African Descent, and February was, of course, US Black History Month. Of course, Esperanza Spalding made history by winning the Grammy Award for Best New Act, and she was the most Googled person in that month. So congratulations to her. Still going to do a few more things concerning the United States stateside. We've got Danelle Harvey, and she's going to do a special report next month while I'm out on the road on tour with Courtney Pine, who's launching his 13th studio album called Europa. But for this month, the topic of the show is Egypt, revolutions and resolutions. You can't have missed all of the news that's going on about Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Gabon, Southern Sudan, Northern Sudan, all of those places. So I've invited a special guest, Sami Bishai, who's an Egyptian jazz violinist and a producer of Natasha Atlas's new album, Munkaliba. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I've invited Sami Bishai onto the show alongside Cole Grant, an Afropean from the Campaign for Truth and Justice. So check it out.
Jazz Reloaded, one voice, giant steps.
UN Resolution 64169, International Year of People of African Descent. We're celebrating the whole year. So, I've managed to track down Sammy Bishop for this show, which I'm really excited about. But somehow I'm going to attempt to get from Sammy Bishop to Egypt, to freedom and democracy in the East, over to freedom and democracy in the West, and back to Sammy Bishai, all in the space of 58 minutes and 30 seconds, so wish me luck. We've also got a guest that's going to help us with the West, Mr. Cole Brown from the Campaign for Truth and Justice, and he's got a quite remarkable story, which I can't even begin to go into in its proper depth in an hour. But if you check out the website
www.ctjnet.co.uk,
that is
www.ctjnet.co.uk,
you check out that website, you're going to find out about a remarkable case that is currently happening in the Free and Fair United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So at this stage, I'd like to invite Sammy to talk a little bit about himself. Sammy is a violinist that, if you come to any of my recent shows, you would have seen him doing something. I don't really want to call it playing the violin, because if you start playing the violin like that, you might not have heard yourself. It takes a long time. But yeah, Sammy, your relationship to Egypt. You were born in Egypt, or?
I was born in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And then grew up in Egypt. My family moved back to Egypt when I was about three. My mother's English, my father was Egyptian. Grew up with both languages. Obviously, culturally absorbed very firsthand the Egyptian side more than the English. The English side I learned more about from reading in books and just word of mouth from what my mom was saying about it, but I didn't spend any time in England until I was about 18, kind of thing. So I had a very Egyptian sort of instant vibe.
Calling for mine again.
Natasha Atlas and your work with her. This is Natasha. You're working with her at the moment?
Yeah. So it's an ongoing association. Basically, I've been playing with her for a few years and in a band playing violin. And at some point, she asked me if I wanted to write some tunes with her and possibly produce an album for her, and that was the...
So this is that you produced this?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And did lots of charts in very, very little amounts of time. And so we were going for a lush, lavish affair with sort of a quasi-orchestral vibe, where it's... she's similar to me. She's half English, half Egyptian, but she was born in Belgium.
Okay.
And grew up in Suffolk, I believe. And so there's a real kind of resonance and empathy, because obviously she speaks Arabic and sings in Arabic, as well as English and French and the same thing. So there's a lot of sort of parallels there. So it was a lot of fun working with someone who had a similar set of cultural references to myself, a similar set of musical cultural references to myself, and a similar desire to explore the kind of more fundamental fusing of the two sides of the musical proceedings, rather than, you know, as opposed to kind of with the bar vibes, where it's like, all right, here's a break beat, and here's an Indian sample, and let's call it world music. And so what we're trying to do is make a real academic fusion, kind of like properly accommodating for quarter tone scales and tonalities in conjunction with we found that jazz harmony was one of the best kind of mediums to actually gel everything together.
Did you have more fun as you played violin on this?
Funny enough, just in the string section, I don't think around having a single violin solo on the whole album.
You didn't have a producer head on.
Yeah.
How did that feel, having the producer head? That's your first time as a producer for this sort of thing, or?
Yeah, for something of this scale and this kind of breadth, yeah.
How did it compare to playing the violin as a, you know, lock and stop session, man?
I miss playing violin.
You miss playing violin.
Well, it was great. It's just a very, very different set of considerations, because I'm supposed to worry about your intonation and your chops and your licks. You're kind of worried about the whole thing, and you as the personal responsibility for everything about it. And if anything's not sounding well, you know, it's suddenly whatever the problem is your problem.
Yep. No, well. So is this something that Sammy Bishai is doing now? Is Sammy a producer? Can I call you to get not dope beats, obviously, but.
Well, funny you should mention that. While we were watching the all of the... basically, there's a lot of things we've been talking about today about the state of... I mean, the actual title is called Mulkalima, which is an Arabic word, which literally means in a state of reversal. Throughout the tunes that we... Because there's a few covers on there, but throughout the tunes that we personally wrote, there's a lot of reference to utopian societies, to the smoke screens in the media, to the general state of the world, to how the corporations are kind of controlling things, various bits and bobs. There's a bunch of interludes that kind of, in theory, sort of segue the whole experience into a complete unified listening experience that kind of goes through various concepts. Anyway, there's two tunes on there that were particularly pertinent to the overall vibe.
Okay.
We were inspired to do a remix called Egypt Rise to Freedom, which is currently out on YouTube.
Wow.
And it's been out for about 4 or 5 days, and it's just hovering around the 60-something thousand hit mark, which obviously means that some people are agreeing with us.
Yeah, I think I checked it out. I think I liked it quite a lot.
Oh, well, that's a good thing. So yeah, so beats are possible.
Egypt Rise to Freedom. This is Tailor Made Radio for jazzreloaded.com. Jazz changes.
We meet at a time of great tension.
Not just a medium of exchange, and even though it is a medium of exchange, there's a reason why the exchange actually has to occur, because of scarcity. If there was no scarcity, there'd be no reason for a medium of exchange, and hence scarcity is money, hence people have to fight for money, and hence differential advantage, gaming strategy, hence dishonesty, hence corruption, hence the world you see around you.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what's going on at the moment with post-revolution Egypt, I there's several passages from several of the readings that just happened kind of correlate quite vividly. There's a lot of parallels between, okay, obviously you have the slavery of black people, and then you have the persecution of Jews throughout time, immemorial kind of thing. But in a larger sense, they're the kind of the two best publicized forms of institutionalized oppression against any one ethnic denomination over the last few hundred years. But in actual fact, what we've got on a large globalized, almost corporate scale, is the oppression of a huge number of ethnic denominations, which, shall we say, the PR of it is more about the fact that they are ethnic denominations that are not Caucasian. But in actual fact, I think it all derives back down to money and economics. And there's a lot of very clever, almost advertising schemes, if you like, the sort of actors' smoke screens where it's like, oh no, it's because he's black, oh no, it's because he's Jewish, oh no, because he's Arab and he's probably a Muslim terrorist, and oh no, it's because he's like Asian, or yeah, whichever kind of ethnic domination you want to delete where applicable kind of vibe. But it, ultimately, most of it is all about money. It's all about the West recovering from the crumbling of the Age of Empires. And most of the unrest that we're seeing internationally, regardless of whether it's riots in South Africa about the lack of services, whether it's riots and the protests burgeoning in Mexico about the increase in the price of corn, whether it's in Brazil about what's going to happen with the potential new kind of reservoir of oil they've got going on, whether it's in, again, whichever Middle Eastern state, whether it's Iran, Egypt, Yemen, Jordan, Syria, probably yet to come. Again, all of this is ultimately about money, because all of the dictators who've been, well, dictators, rulers, presidents, whatever you want to call them, who've been in charge of these territories have very much been put there by the West, because they, in some way, align their political regimes in accordance with Western financial agendas.
Well, this is an interesting thing about the little bit of coverage that I saw of, like, from Sky News and BBC News. It was a difficult time for them because they couldn't 100% be anti-Mubarak, because in the past, the whole Mubarak thing worked out quite well for certain Western corporate interests. So there couldn't be a complete denouncement. What I did see was other, you know, side groups like the Muslim Brotherhood being blamed for the disturbances. But then it was confusing because they weren't sure whether to call them riots or democratic uprisings or civil unrest. But what was your interpretation of it? How did you see any of that news? Or
I was glued to it from the second it kicked off.
Okay.
I just pressed pause on my life and stuck in front of like various news channels surfing constantly and trying to get reviews done at the same time. So kind of meet the sound, put on stuff and go back to the thing, you know. Because that kind of vibe. I thought it was very interesting because obviously you've got your very mainstream corporate news channels like Fox, like Sky, like or even CNN to a degree. They've got one very specific set of vocabulary associated with covering the events. Then you've got BBC, which is kind of a little bit more on the fence about some things and more biased in other ways. And then you've got the whole other vibe of Al Jazeera, whether it's the English or the Arabic vibe. Now, the Arabic vibe was calling it spade a spade. The Arabic channel was just like, yep, it's a revolution, and they're trying to get rid of the dictator, Hosni Mubarak, who has been sympathetic to the corporation, blah, 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 blah. The English one was a little bit kind of less kind of, alright, this is how things are. The English one was a lot more kind of, right, well, there's protests. We're not going to use the R word because, you know, you don't really want to call it a revolution until things turn one way or the other. And you do want to ultimately be backing the winning horse, really, because you can't really afford to be kind of saying the wrong things to the wrong people just in case you end up on the wrong side of the wrong person post de facto.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that kind of, obviously, I mean, and that was a kind of a more open, like Al Jazeera English was a hell of a lot more open than what you're seeing on all the purely Western corporate kind of news channels. They were like, oh, there's a turmoil. Turmoil was the most frequently used word. And so now back to the turmoil in Egypt. Join us with our live blah, blah, blah in Cairo. So covering the turmoil in the streets. It's like, well, look, it's the only aspects of turmoil kicking off there are the ways the police are dealing with it, the way the government is actually manifesting in a sort of an unseen hand kind of way. Half of the fights breaking out with the riots were actually policemen in plain clothes, deliberately muck stirring just to make it look as violent as possible, because then they can justify on an international on the international playing field of the media the involvement of the secret police, the state police, and the army in quelling the uprisings, in quelling the disturbances, and ultimately crushing any sense of opposition to the existing status quo.
What happens now in Egypt, now that Mubarak has gone? Is that the end of the turmoil, or is there continued uprising? Or, you know, I got the sense that the issue wasn't removing Mubarak per se, but changing the way that things operate in Egypt. Is that accurate? Would you say that's accurate?
I'd say that's hugely accurate. I think one of the things that was upsetting me the most about all of the initial news coverage as of January 25th, for about the first 10 days even, it was very much about making out that the Egyptian people were demonizing Mubarak as the kind of the figurehead of the whole thing, and that it was just him that's toppling the man. They made the man representative of the entire system. Obviously, that is a gross oversimplification of the actual case.
Yep.
Because obviously, okay, fine, so the rumors say that say Mubarak alone amassed a personal fortune of roughly $70 billion, or £40 million. His two sons have been obviously favoured by the regime and the institution in terms of any kind of business dealings they wanted.
Good old nepotism.
You know what I mean? You can't go wrong with the old father-son vibes with this. It's a remember the force book.
Yeah. And well, I guess everyone's looking out for their own in some way or another, which, well, I guess Corley also had an experience of that, you know. And people, you know, looking out for their own interest.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think it's possibly, you know, maybe the government or even the press have got a bigger responsibility. I saw an article by Gary Young in The Guardian. I think I sent it to you. It seemed to make quite a lot of sense to me. I mean, one point that he makes is that the events of the last month in Tunisia, Egypt and elsewhere, I mean, this is an interesting thing for me as well, because I noticed that, you know, particularly Egypt, you know, Saudi Arabia is always referred to as the region, but continentally and geographically, if you look at it, it's Africa.
Mm. Well, no, this goes back to the fact that the definition of Arabic or Middle Eastern territories goes back to defining it by its religion and by its primary language. Yeah. Now, obviously, the whole sort of Islamic Empire, I think, it started about the 7th century AD, and spread from the main Arabic region, the Gulf region around the peninsula and the Red Sea and all that, all across the north bit of Africa.
Yep.
And this is, I think, another really crass generalization the West tends to make, both in the media and politically and diplomatically, in terms of how they actually maintain their relationships with the various countries within the territory. It's this whole kind of, it's this kind of ethnic minority. They're all either Muslims or terrorists or Arabs or Africans, whatever. Just put them in the same junk basket and deprive them of all the same stuff in very broad sense. It's very easy to sound conspiracy theory nut about all of this, but when you actually look at the way the regimes have been maintained by through diplomatic relations over the last 50 years, 60 years, basically ever since the end of World War II, you know, going back to the old age of empires crumbling kind of thing, Europe was brought to its knees economically and resource-wise by World War II, and it was still recovering from being brought to its knees by the First World War. Obviously, they could barely maintain internal security and so just general relationships internally within Europe, let alone their colonies in England's example, in various Arabic territories, in North Africa, in India. It was all getting a little bit too much because, you know, I mean, people were on ration books for food inside of England for a good few years after World War II finished. It was still powdered eggs, powdered milk. You know, if you can't add water to it, forget it, you're not getting anything fresh.
I think that's where a lot of our consumers' tastes come from and persist. You know, a lot of artificial flavours and colours are substitutes for things that, you know, it wasn't possible to get for whatever reason at the time. I still make the point that, you know, we're seeing this uprising in Zimbabwe, obviously. You know, we're seeing it in Sudan, North and South Sudan. We're seeing it in the Ivory Coast, the ongoing thing in Darfur, Tunisia, Algeria. So for me, you know, particularly in this year, the promotion of the African, I think it's interesting to focus on it, irrespective of religion, irrespective of nationality, irrespective of politics, because the core thing is Africanism, whatever that is, and that's something that we have to define for ourselves. For me, we can look at the situation since 1961, which was the last year of International Year of People of African Descent, and see what's changed for Africans in the diaspora in the UK and in the United States, and see how we fit. Because as Gary makes it the point in his article, what it's called, the West can no longer claim to be an honest broker in the search for peace. How do you feel about that statement?
Well, I feel that today, whatever the state can get away with behind closed doors, they're going to get away with, or attempt to get away with. And I think they weren't probably prepared for the new forms of medium that's available today, so that they aren't able to blind the people as well as they've been able to in the past. And so with the age of the internet and so forth and so on, and like shows like this, bringing the truth to people, enabling people to open their minds rather than be brainwashed in a particular way. So indeed, from a lot of things that we thought we'd have already overcome, still goes on goes on today.
Well, I mean, this has been your particular experience, yeah. Obviously. You know, how would you say things have changed, or have things changed for Africans in the diaspora, or Africans, as I prefer to use the term, say for the last 30 years, in terms of, you know, law and order, justice? What would you say has changed or hasn't changed?
I would say that we continue to be denied justice, in particularly because, as I said, I use the term behind closed doors. Unless it's something horrific like black-on-black crimes, it doesn't get media attention. And it would appear that black issues, or African issues, if you like, are unimportant. And so it doesn't get reported in the media. Now, one of the greatest forms of weapons I believe the state has in any region or country is silence. Where there is nothing brought to the attention of the general public, then it allows them a route to be able to deny the basic fundamental rights that people have come to expect from all the sacrifices that have been previously made to achieve that.
As a citizen of Her Majesty's Kingdom, mm-hmm. as a contributor, as a taxpayer, mm-hmm. what are your expectations in 2011 of the justice system, the legal system, the society? What your expectation? What do you feel you can expect?
You know, I was born in this country, but my mother sent me to Jamaica when I was 11 months old. And at the time when she was sending me out of the country, the state told her, that if this country ever was involved in war whilst I was still abroad, that they would come to get me to possibly take part, to lay down my life for my country. And I cannot believe that in the country of my birth, the country where I would be expected to lay down my life if necessary, that the level of injustice which I have personally experienced, for instance, having spent 6 years unlawfully locked up in this country without having any access to court at all, I would not believe that this could happen at any time at all in this country, let alone now, 2011. You know, and I mean, we've been brainwashed in a way to believe that there is no justice. But I cannot ever accept, whilst I have a breath of life in me, that there is no such thing as justice. I think it's the people that determine justice.
Well, you've actually taken the fight to the courts, and you know, you've asked for your day in court, as it were. Can you give us, like, I know it's very difficult. I mean, I've been lucky to be able to read the website and check out the video, so I know that a little bit about the background of your history. But can you give like a short summation of what exactly has happened in your experience in the last 20, 30 years?
Okay, well, I mean, basically, and obviously from a personal point, the history of this started back in 1994. When my 15-month-old son was left to die in a state hospital from dehydration, from lack of fluids. And in addition to his death, a whole hour before he died, I was at the hospital looking for my family and was repeatedly told, "Your son's not here, he's well, he only had a tummy upset." Only to be subsequently later on told, "Oh, come quickly, your son's here, he's not well," and then rushing back to go and find my son dead. Now the state has engaged every ounce, every arm of its machinery to keep all that quiet. And that is when they engaged the machinery of imprisonment to have me locked up in prison back in 1999, when a senior High Court judge presided over a matter that was being prosecuted by his brother. Now, that is what I understand previously, that people have laid down their lives to prevent people from being locked up without trial, without charge, etc. To prevent injustice of you mentioned nepotism earlier on. I mean, this was of the worst kind. One brother going to another and saying, "Oh, I've got this problem, I need your help." And this judge ordered or issued a warrant for me to be picked up from the street and brought straight to prison without charge, without trial. I remained in prison, unlawfully imprisoned, for 2 months before the prison authorities realized I shouldn't have been there. And they presented me in court, and then another judge released me from that period of imprisonment. Now, I refused to accept to be told to be disciplined by someone who's not prepared to be disciplined themselves. I refuse to be governed by a law, by anyone who's not prepared to be governed by that law themselves. And I believe, it's, as I've heard them say quite repeatedly, especially with the right of prisoners to vote and how they acted in Parliament, I heard one politician say that it is not for the lawbreakers to be the lawmakers. You cannot be a lawbreaker and be a lawmaker. So if you are violated the law, you have no right to try and impose law on me. Because, you know, as it says, how can you question me about the speck of sawdust in my eyes whilst having a huge plank in your own? So,
well, this is the question for both of you then. Bearing in mind that that was 1999, and bearing in mind that this is 2011, how likely do you think it is that your situation can happen again to a person like you? How likely do you think that the situation in Egypt can happen again?
Well, I mean, until this matter is exposed, because right now I have no idea of how many other people have suffered, possibly still, probably still incarcerated unlawfully. So it could still be going on. But until this is brought to the attention of the British people and to the world as a whole, then it is very likely that it can continue. Because this is one of those cases where, because of the impact that it could have on the whole damn system, because it would expose the lack of integrity in the whole system, it could bring the whole damn system down. So I would imagine that if there are other cases out there that can expose the system in the same way, then they would be subjected to a similar sort of treatment. I mean, the sentence that I was subjected to was one that would have kept me inside for the longest possible period, and with the hope, I'm sure, that it might have broken me and certainly caused my organisation, Campaign for Truth and Justice, to disband. So, but unfortunately, as with
great speeches by African Americans,
right? When you go through something like that, it strengthens you. You don't become broken. You know, Mandela, irrespective of what we might think of the situation in South Africa today, Mandela would have been strengthened by through the experience.
Let me ask you both this question: how close is the United States or the UK to an Egypt-style state of turmoil? And do either of you think that something like that will be useful here or needed?
I think just very briefly refer back to the last question. I think I've maintained for a long time and been told that I'm a complete conspiracy nut, that exactly that kind of unlawful incarceration occurs as frequently in the West as it has in places like Egypt or like South Africa or like whichever, again, the League of Arab or African / Arabic nation. But there's a general illusion here of safety, there's an illusion of freedom, there's an illusion of legal properness that is insurmountable and unassailable correctness and justice. And that. But it feels, to be honest, I mean, it's absolutely terrifying hearing about what happened to yourself, yeah. Because that is exactly the stuff that has been going on in Egypt ever since specifically 1967, yeah. Which is when they passed the emergency law. Which was supposed to be because there was a military conflict between Egypt and Israel, except conveniently it's referred to in Western history books as the Six-Day War. Okay. It was actually a six-year war that finished in 1973. In theory, the emergency law should have been lifted at 73, at the end of the 6th of October 73. It wasn't. It was still running until literally a week ago.
Okay.
And it's actually still running. It's supposed to be lifted over the next 10 days. But basically what that emergency law stated was the equivalent to the USA Patriot Act, which basically means, all right, we can grab anybody of questionable look / origin / ethnicity / unpleasant religion / etc. And
which is kind of how UK law can be interpreted at the moment.
Absolutely, which is, again, terrifying, because it's not actually... I think if you grab Joe Bloggs off the street and say, do you think the police have the right to just grab you, bung you in the back of a van, and chuck you in jail, and you don't get your phone call, you don't get your lawyer, you don't get any kind of legal counsel, you're not even told why you're being held. It's popularly conceived of in Western Europe that that is highly unlikely, because we're not as corrupt as those states with dodgy military dictators or whatever. But I maintain that, you know, according to your experiences, and I'm sure countless others, that is very much the case. I mean, post 9/11, all sorts of laws were passed internationally, which basically gave the West very explicitly outlined equal dictatorial rights as all of these other sort of third world developing countries that we need to be afraid of because they threaten our way of life and our freedom, etc., etc.
I wonder if there's, you know, in my own experience, there's a sense that I remember growing up that the police do whatever they want to do. Rightly or wrongly, that's the impression I got from the way that the police operated in my area. Mm. For me, it didn't even get as far as what your rights might be. I know there's been a number of cases of police brutality and probably deaths in custody, to the point where, you know, if you were in an area where the police were, you were probably just doing your best to stay alive and get out of trouble. So in my experience, it probably didn't go even as far as saying, well, look, what should my rights be in this situation? The point being, how much progress have we really made if, at the end of the day, we're still talking about freedom from physical persecution? We're not even talking about the level of freedom from emotional persecution. Because, I mean, as the lovely sirens will attest to, once you've got that as a soundtrack for 24 hours a day, all the police helicopters going across, I think it's a form of emotional persecution. Absolutely. So on what basis does this country or does America make a claim for saying it's done that much more in terms of human rights, civil rights, and free rights? Do you feel that claim could be made? Or?
I think the case for freedom is pretty much the same internationally, really, because at the end of the day, governmental agendas are either dictated by international corporate structures, which are, I mean, let's face it, most governments are bankrupt. This is the essence of the economic crisis that we're experiencing at the moment. And as a result, their entire kind of fiscal policies, their legislative procedures, all of it is dictated by corporate structures who've got all the money. I mean, Barclays had a 32% increase in profits this year, which translates into 6 point something million pounds. Now, do you know what I mean? A 32% hike in, I mean, imagine if your gig fees went up by 32% universally. It would be time to retire.
What gig fees?
Then let's get started on that one. But do you know what I mean? The only sector where you get that kind of expansion happening is in the financial sector. It's in the speculative markets. It's in the stocks and shares, which is, again, just a brief sort of reality check. You're betting on what might or might not be worth more or less money in a yet as unspecified day about products that don't even exist yet, whether it's oil that's been mined or wheat that has been harvested. You're talking about playing with virtual money that hasn't even become real virtual money yet, let alone real money. And that is where all the money's being made. And that is the system that is governing all governments' legal procedures, the laws that are being passed, the kind of the way it's all running. So at the end of the day, things like prison structures, the rights to free speech, all these things, these are all essentially kind of superficial. Well, it feels to me anyway, they're just superficial exercises in making it look to the general public that there's some semblance of civil liberty, that there's some semblance of freedom, and there's some semblance of equality, regardless of race or gender or religion or denomination or creed, which kind of, to me, feels like this massive way of keeping us involved in the day-to-day difficulties of not making rent, of not being able to pay our electricity bills, our heating bills in the winter, da 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 da. I mean,
I was going to say something quite similar, that they've gone through the motions to make it appear on the surface that they've done all these things to ensure rights and so forth and so on. Underneath the surface, as far as I'm concerned, without a question of doubt, if the issues which have been raised just now were to come to the surface, if the truth was revealed, the whole damn system would be exposed, yeah. And there would be no recovery from it. And so, because quite literally, you know, if you ask me today, how would I interpret democracy? I would say democracy is the will of the people, if you like, or it ought to be. And that's what we've seen in Egypt, that despite the fact that, you know, this Mubarak was hell-bent on staying, etc., 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 because of world media, if the world media had not been focused on it, he might have just used the army to do whatever he wanted to do.
Well, he very much wouldn't, because that's what he has done in the past.
Exactly. So because world media was there, that applied pressure, it gave the people the necessary courage to stand up and be counted and allow, if you like, some form of democracy to take place, in that it forced him, people power, forced him to step down. In the same exact way, if the issues here were exposed, the system as it stands could not stand. And I see, for instance, the argument you raised, it would elevate this sort of argument for people to be able to look and hear without thinking of a conspiracy theory. I mean, I'm in touch with a number of people who I was searching there. I wasn't being rude. I was searching for the speech because I get a lot of emails from a lot of people who are actively involved in trying to expose the system for the way you described it, Juman. I'm not expert enough to engage in that speech, but yeah, I'm aware of other people who are saying exactly the same thing as you're saying, but I'm equally aware of the fact that they will do whatever is necessary to try to hide from the rest of us the truth of what's gone on. You just look at things like MPs' expenses, and I'm not belittling this, but just look at what's been taking place for decades and the reaction and how quickly they had to act for fear of public reprisal. You know, if the public, the people as a whole, especially in the countries that claim to be a democracy and to be the leaders in that field of democracy, if the world, if the public got to learn of the hypocrisy in reality of what's taking place, there would be absolute outrage and they could not withstand it. And in the same way, again, as happened in Egypt, the army couldn't get involved in these things. They would have to side the people.
Bringing it back to a more local focus, as a question I just thought of, who is your MP in your constituency and how supportive have they been of your issue? And who's your MP in your constituency and how supportive have they been of you as a musician or as any other type of...
They have structures for that, yeah. Support for musicians. I thought it was supposed to be executed en masse as soon as possible.
Who's your MP?
My MP is Lynn Brown. It used to be Tony Banks, anyway, before he died, mysteriously. But Lynn Brown, who has not been in any way, shape or form supportive.
Oh, wow.
She, I think now, she refuses to see me at her surgery, but she wrote to me several times whilst I was in prison, telling me that she could not represent me as she's not a lawyer. And I wrote back to her at one point saying, look, I don't want you to represent me in a court of law. I want you to represent, or in the ordinary sense of court of law, I want you to represent me in Parliament, where you are supposed to be a lawmaker. So you ought to know about the law. But as I said, the response on her has been very negative. It's all the letters that I received from people like her was kind of psychologically written in a way that to have an impact on my mind, to maybe, as I said, not to survive the whole situation. As you mentioned MPs, I'm not encroaching on your time. I held back on a particular letter that from an MP. I thought, you know, I better not bring it just in case you know her and it may...
Yeah, I find it very difficult talking about MPs because, I mean, particularly as an Afro-European person, there's so few Afro-European MPs that any type of charge or claim made against them is immediately biased just because they can't possibly deal with a number. And because there's only two or three of them, I think maybe three or four, they're dealing with 400 or 500 complaints, which they're obviously going to do. It's going to look proportionately bad, and I don't.
But this one, she wrote me a letter back in 1998. I mean, I've had letters from you and Bernie Grant, who's from your constituency, mm-hmm. passed away. And
yes, of all the now.
Yeah, that's right. Of all the MPs, I think I've had a letter from him as well. Of all the MPs that have written to me, this one wrote, Byman and Partners were correct to say that there is no law in this country that allows anyone to sue for false advice. You have to face the fact that nothing will bring your son back. Drop this action against Byman and get on with the rest of your life. This was what this MP wrote.
Verbatim.
Absolutely verbatim.
Wow.
Diane Abbott.
Notwithstanding malpractice, inefficiency, the NHS falling to pieces, but no one's ability to assume responsibility, nothing. No culpability, no accountability.
Nothing whatsoever. The most disturbing point of that was you have to face the fact that nothing will bring your son back. So, in fact, what she's saying is, if someone goes out there and murders someone and you have the person who did it, there's no point prosecuting them because prosecuting that person is not going to bring the murdered person back. You know, giving a grieving parent some answers as to how this happened, maybe reassurance as to procedures put in place that will never allow it to happen again. No, this person wrote, you have to face the fact that I wish I had brought the letter and given you the opportunity to say, but I just didn't want to. I was afraid of there being, oh, I know that person, so I can't.
Well, no, not at all. Not at all on this show. I mean, I would make the point that, like I said, if my MP is David Lammy. I think that's all I need to say about that particular situation. I think just lower the price a little bit so that Spurs can stay. Just a little bit, just like 250 instead of 302. But anyway, yeah, it's well, on a serious note, I wonder, you know, if you can't turn to your MP and you can't turn to the courts, I think this was the central point of your claim. You've got no access to any form of redress. So what do they expect you
to do?
And the reason why, you know, you're looking for a tenuous connection back to jazz, I think a lot of the blues and a lot of jazz music comes as a point of that social protest. Circumstances similar to yours that really encourage music to manifest. Not that I'm advocating putting yourself in that situation to get chops.
Well, if you think about it, like conceptually, on a very, very academic level, jazz is all about improvising. Improvising is about reacting to your sonic context and your musical context, which serves as a very good allegory for what I think we all need to do as citizens of the world, regardless of whether we're Afro-Asian or Arabs or the thing. The whole point is that we need to be aware of our context, listen to what the hell's going on, look at what's going on, assume the responsibility to understand what it means, both in the individual context of our own lives and the broader context of us as a society and an international collective of peoples trying to get along, and react. This is the trouble. We are all so engaged in channel surfing and watching crap news about nonsense, about X Factor, about Simon Cowell, how high his trousers are, that we kind of forget that in actual fact this is all kind of distracting us from very, very important things. Things that actually do affect us on a directly significant level in terms of liberty, in terms of democracy. I mean, democracy sounds like a brilliant idea, but I don't really know if it exists. It seems to be a real ideal rather than a system in practice anywhere in the world. Because if England is supposed to be, I mean, look, England is one of the G20 countries, is one of the most affluent, one of the most economically influential powers in the world. Forget just the West, in the world. Likewise, America, etc., etc. Now, these kind of, you know, the Patriot Act, your unlawful incarceration without even so much as a phone call for 2 months, all of these kind of things are exactly the sort of thing that flea-bit dictatorships have been accused of for years. And it's also the sort of the bogeyman for the West. It's like, oh, no, look, you have to vote for either the Tories or the Conservative, the Labour, otherwise you might end up with some crap going on like, you know, Egypt or Iran, where, you know, religion and all this madness and, oh, the Muslims, they're an unknown quantity, aren't they? Imagine if they got into power. Do you really want a Muslim MP for your constituency? Vote Tory. Yeah. You know, all this kind of stuff.
So there would be probably Storr and David Cameron's address on multiculturalism. For he went to Germany. Yeah, Munich. The home of the former National Socialist Party. to echo the sentiments of the current Chancellor of Germany, that multicultural failed. But I thought it was really, interesting. One point that I picked up on, it started as a sort of anti-Islamic or anti-extreme Islam statement, which was presumably his opinion. It seemed to lack an example. When it came down to examples, the Prime Minister started talking in terms of black and white. It's specifically white and non-white. And I found it hard to make the leap or the connection between extreme Islam and white and non-white. And I think he's, you can check it online, but his thing was like, well, you know, when we talk to white people about racism, you know, they're quite naturally, you know, ashamed or, you know, they're censured and stuff. But when we speak to non-white people about racism, there's a sense that we don't want to offend them. But I thought that was just a really strange approach for a Prime Minister of England to go to Germany to make that statement. Mm-hmm. We've got 5 minutes left and we haven't spoken about music, but I think...
Music's bad for you. Music's bad for you. Music has got to go in the new world order. It's the first thing that we need to get rid of.
Well,
struck a chord. Which one? It doesn't matter, it's jazz.
Jazz Reloaded. Jazz changes.
JazzReloaded.com.
All our music comes from the heart and soul. Start by listening. It is music that takes its roots from Africa.
Jazz Reloaded.
And we embrace the rule that we are.
The collective set of building blocks from which human reality is made.
JazzReloaded.com. Jazz changes.
It's as if there is this great reservoir outside of time and space. Patterns, energy.
This is a very, very important message.
It is a system which has conscripted human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine.
JazzReloaded.com.
Mankind struggles to give a definition like this.
Combine diplomatic, intelligent, economic, scientific, and political.
Funny,
because
I don't know anything about music.
You
don't have to know anything about music. Just listen to it, that's all.
First of all, you have to respect your culture.
Come on, Shaggy! Are you ready?
Music from another land, made in England.
Well, what do you think?
Jazz, open up the mind.
Jazz soul, spoken word, from the roots to the fruit. This is Jazz Reloaded.
I will not make any deals with you. I've resigned. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, deed, or numbered. My life is my own.
Jazz
Reloaded.
Reloaded.
Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded. Reloaded.